Welcome to Heard at Heritage. Heard at Heritage features cutting-edge analysis and thought from leading experts in and across the conservative movement, as well as premier events and programming from the Heritage Foundation here in the heart of Washington, D.C., brought straight to you.
Well, welcome everybody to the Heritage Foundation, and thank you for joining us for the third annual Edwin Meese III Originalism Lecture, which will be delivered tonight by my good friend, Professor John Yoo. This lecture honors the former U.S. Attorney General, Ed Meese, who through a series of speeches in 1985 and 1986 was instrumental in sparking a revolution in the law by reinvigorating what he called a jurisprudence of original intention. This, of course, should not have been revolutionary at all, since judges prior to the progressive era had long practiced originalism. But times had certainly changed, that is, until Ed Meese came along. And look how far we have come since then. A solid majority of justices on the Supreme Court today are self-professed originalists. And during her confirmation hearing, Justice Elena Kagan went so far as to say, "Today, we are all originalists." I am delighted that the man who sparked this revolution, Ed Meese, is here with us this evening. Tonight, John Yoo will speak about, can originalism be moral? John is the Emanuel Heller Professor of Law at the University of California at Berkeley, where he also directs the Public Law and Policy Program and the Korea Law Center. He's also a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. He began his legal career by clerking for two legal giants, Judge Lawrence Silberman on the D.C. Circuit and Justice Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. He's written over 100 articles and several books, including his latest one, which he co-authored with Robert Delahunty, The Politically Incorrect Guide to the Supreme Court. John also served as a Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel and as General Counsel to the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. Please join me in welcoming John Yoo.
Thanks, John, for that introduction. It's really great to be here. The last time John asked me to speak at Heritage, he asked me to simultaneously roast Justice Thomas and Judge Silberman. I got to tell you, it's a bad idea to make jokes of people who can put the death penalty to you. Thanks, John. I'm also glad John's here because, as you may know, he just returned from a trip to Japan. I did not know that the Japanese were now interested in Civil War reenactments, but this is wonderful advancement of American culture in the East. It's also a great pleasure to be here at the Heritage Foundation. It reminds me of the last time I spoke during a presidential election year at Heritage, where after the November election, I landed in Washington, I got a cab and I said, "Take me to the Trump transition headquarters," and they delivered me here. I didn't know you took that joke seriously, because now it's the same place. I also am very honored to speak in the third person in the series. Hey, Alex. In the third person in the series, after Professors Blackman and Lash. And after looking at their distinguished speeches, I have to say again, John, what took you so long to get to me? And they're both, it's very hard to follow in their footsteps, so I'm gonna do my best and try to address some of the questions that they raised about originalism. And let me also say one last thing about General Meese. One thing that is sometimes obscured in General Meese's biography is that he is a graduate of the University of California at Berkeley Law School. And one of our proudest graduates and winner of the Alumni Award given to him by Dean Chris Edley. I'm not sure Dean Chemerinsky would have given you the award. And the reason I say that is because we just did a conference at Berkeley where I asked the Heritage Foundation to come and go head to head with Chesa Boudin's Murderer's Row. And it was a wonderful conference. The last one we had right before COVID, General Meese came, and Dean Chemerinsky got up, welcomed everybody, and then proceeded to go on a 10-minute attack on the Roberts Court for its criminal procedure decisions. General Meese, who was also supposed to make some welcoming remarks, then got up, and I think I just want to capture the subtlety of your thought, General Meese, where you said, "Irwin, the Warren Court is over." And then proceeded to do a 10-minute point-by-point rebuttal of Irwin to show him that the court had come to its senses on criminal procedure. It was a wonderful event. The other thing I'd like to say about General Meese, and this is the topic of my talk, is originalism, is I don't think we would be here talking about originalism if it were not for him. I think he was the last of the, I would call them, intellectual attorney generals. Today we think about attorney generals about how many people they put in jail, right? Our attorney generals today are home secretaries. General Meese harkened back to the original attorney generals who were advisors to the government about the Constitution and its meaning. And his speech on originalism was part of that great effort, along with your efforts to get constitutionalists appointed to the Supreme Court and the lower courts. I just point out, after you gave your famous speech on originalism, I went and looked this up. Even though there were many critics on the court itself, you know, you prompted William Brennan to give a speech directly responding to you. I did what passes in my house for empirical research and went to Westlaw, asked the AI some questions. The AI said that after your speech, citations to the Federalist Papers in Supreme Court opinions went up 600%. So, for the kids out there, that's almost as much growth as the federal deficit. I have to admit, this speech and the topic is completely, I'm trying this out for the first time. I really welcome your comments. If you like it, I think I'll turn it into a Law Review article. If you don't like it, I'm gonna ask my 16-year-old nephew to remove all traces of it from the internet. I'm really not sure how it will go over, but it's a response to, I think, I call the crisis of originalism. The interesting thing is originalism, I would say now, is at the height of its acceptance in the bar and on the courts, where you have, I would say, a majority of the Supreme Court, maybe even a supermajority, who say they're originalists or at least strive towards originalism. But at the same time, there is internal doubt about originalism. We are in the middle, I think, of not the 1619 Project type attacks on originalism on the founding, but self-doubt and criticism of originalism by those who are conservatives. This is what I think is so surprising. At the very height of originalism's victory, the fulfillment of General Meese's wishes, we are now engaged, I think, in a furious debate within conservatism about originalism. My very good friend Adrian Vermeule, project on common good constitutionalism, is the latest and most prominent of these critiques. Professor Vermeule would say, and part of this I agree with, he would say, originalism itself is not a moral theory. Originalism itself doesn't promote good or bad morality. You have to go to the law itself. If the law is good, then originalism is good. If the law were bad, then maybe originalism is bad. But his main point is to evaluate originalism, you have to look at the outputs and then judge that against some kind of external moral theory. And then other conservatives have engaged in a large discussion, I would say, vigorous discussion about what that external moral theory should be. You have Randy Barnett, no stranger to Heritage, who would say that it should be filled in by a fairly libertarian notion of individual rights. You have, I think, people like Hadley Arkes and the, what I call the Claremont School, who would say you should also have some kind of natural law elements, although he would say you would use common sense to fill in the moral gaps in the Constitution. John Malcolm made me read a piece by Joel Alicea, which I had yet to read, but I'm glad I read it, who would say the natural law itself requires, for moral reasons, that we accept the authoritative decisions of people that the of leaders that the people have chosen, and so obeying the decisions of those choices itself is moral. So I am going to try to suggest a way to think of originalism and the Constitution as being moral, but in a way that I think precedes or is necessary for these other theories to succeed. And part of that is because our Constitution and our country are different than other countries and other constitutions. I think in a world where you have, for example, in France, you have the French people pre-exist the French nation state and take in and pass, enact, throw out, change constitutions regularly. In countries where the Constitution is just an instrument, like a statute, then I think the idea of the Constitution and originalism having no moral content but just being instruments might make more sense. And that's why it's not no surprise, I think, that the criticism of originalism comes from people who are quite interested and enamored of the civil law system and European approaches to the law. But I think the Americans are different. The United States is different. We were not a people before the Constitution. In fact, the Constitution is what creates and defines the American nation rather than the other way around. And so if the Constitution itself is what creates our nation state, which creates us as a nation, then I think it's possible for the Constitution itself to be morally good, putting apart its just outcomes or its results in cases in from case to case. That's because, in part, and I am happy to say, I think this is still a dirty word in Washington. I'm an American exceptionalist, I think. I think that you're not allowed to say that. At least at Berkeley, I've been reported by now. but yeah, I'm an American exceptionalist. I think America is different. I do think that it has been a force for good in the world, not just now, but historically in the history of the world. Has been, I think, undeniably the best thing that ever happened to the world. Think about how the world would have been different if we had never had our Constitution, if we had been an appendage of the British Empire. I'm told various princes at Heritage Foundation is interested in would clearly be citizens of the United States if that were the case. I'm referring to Prince whatever his name is, Harry, and how he got into the country. I think you guys are on that. So I think that's a case of, I don't think England wants him back. So where would you remove him to if he's here illegally? But I think that the United States has been an incredible force for good historically and comparatively right now. And if that's the case, then the things that were essential to creating the United States as a nation state themselves are good, and originalism, teaching us to try to understand and give force to what the people who wrote the Constitution wrote together, that document that allowed us to become a nation, is good and then has a moral content to it. So let me briefly explain why it doesn't have to do exactly with the exact provisions in the Constitution itself. It's because I think in our case, the Constitution was able to bring us together as a nation because if you go back to the founding, we clearly were a country that had serious regional divisions. We had a North and a South, different economic systems, right? One, the South, unfortunately, built on slavery. The North built on freedom. Those two sides had to come together for us to be a nation. They deeply distrusted each other, despite the fact that there were enormous, obvious public benefits for the two parts of our country to come together into one nation. You consider the massive, free market it created, the defense against all these powers on our borders, the ability to expand to the West, the ability to accept millions of people searching for a better life to come to the United States. How did they come together? They came together because the Constitution was a document that not just listed provision by provision what we were going to do on this question or that question, but it was a document that shared power between the North and the South in a way that they could both trust each other. And that's, to me, what the Constitution represents before you even get to the provisions, is that in an era, in a situation where parts of the country or groups in the country cannot trust each other to come together. And it's not surprising that it's very difficult to trust each other. There's no Supreme Court in existence yet. Right? There's no enforcement authority in existence yet. Nevertheless, the two sides have to agree to come together to become the United States and to do all the good that it has as a nation. So how do you do that? You have a written constitution. I think that's one of the things that the founders discovered that had not been discovered before, is that a written constitution is a device that promotes trust between different regions, different groups in a society, that people will keep their bargains and fulfill their promises about the future, about how they will share power. In international relations, this has the same problem. How did two countries ever make a treaty together? How do they ever make an agreement with each other when there's no international court that has any real enforcement authority to carry out the terms? And international relations theory says, and this comes from actually basic contract theory, says that if you have two sides, they want to make an agreement, there's no enforcement authority, you have to engage in what's called credible commitments. You have to send signals to each other that you're trustworthy, that you're not going to break your word, even if one side becomes much more powerful in the deal as it goes into effect, that you're still going to keep your word. And the way you do that is doing things that are expensive. Well, the most expensive thing you could do is come up with a written constitution with a Supreme Court that will enforce its terms. So how do I test this? There's no way to test this as a theory, but I think one way to understand this is to look at the Dred Scott and the coming of the Civil War as an example. So if you go back to Dred Scott and the Civil War, right, Chief Justice Taney, writing for the court, I think seriously misconstrues the original understanding of the Constitution. He says that Congress cannot regulate slavery in the territories. And the logic of his opinion, that because slaves were property, their ownership and their movement could not be restricted by the federal government without violating the Takings Clause and the Due Process Clause, ultimately meant that the theory of Dred Scott would say that the free northern states would be able to keep slavery out. That ultimately, and this was Lincoln's criticism of Dred Scott, that ultimately the logic of Dred Scott is that, right, the country would either have to be all free or all slave. Dred Scott seemed to suggest it was going to be all slave. What that showed, I think, in this case is by the Supreme Court not obeying the original understanding of the Constitution, the original deal that put the North and South together. The two regions could no longer trust each other to obey the Constitution because there would no longer be a Supreme Court you could trust to honor and enforce the original terms of the deal. And so how could you prevent the coming of the Civil War then, if you've already shown that there's no way to keep the bargain between the two regions? And it's not, as some people would say, the Supreme Court should look at what people today thought the deal of the Constitution was. It's important that they keep the original terms of the deal, because it was that agreement that allowed the two sides to reach a power sharing agreement that was our Constitution. And that's why I think originalism, if you look at it in the context of Dred Scott, answers the question of, can originalism be moral? It can be moral because it's a necessary, not moral thing in itself to have, not the aim of it, it's an individual provisions pass everyone's test for morality. It's that the Constitution was necessary to create the nation state of the United States, and that that nation state then in existence can then go on to do all the things that all of these other critics of originalism would want, whether it's protect natural rights. I know Roger Pilon is here, and I am in full agreement with him that our Constitution is there to protect the natural rights and the Declaration of Independence. That's not possible without the creation of the United States as a nation state, which will then protect those natural rights. Or if people of the Adrian Vermeule School, the Common Good Constitutionalism School, want to have the metric be common good as understood by the long train of thinkers from Aristotle to Augustine to Aquinas and since, those rights, that common good cannot be pursued unless there is a viable, strong nation state in existence. And that's not possible without a constitution. So I guess in closing, and I really look forward to your comments. I look forward to John's questions. I guess I'm really persuaded by Daniel Webster. And for the youngsters out there, Daniel Webster was much more important than having the dictionary named after him. That's actually Noah Webster, by the way. But Daniel Webster was once considered one of the greatest senators, maybe gave one of the greatest speeches in the history of the Senate. And he tried to capture this idea of individual rights, natural rights, and freedom being important. Lincoln thought them ultimately important, but not possible without the Union. So Daniel Webster said in his famous speech, he said, liberty and union, right, now and forever, one and inseparable. And I think that's the lesson of the American experience and why the Constitution and originalism are moral, because they make that liberty and union possible. So thank you very much for bearing with me and hearing my tentative thoughts on originalism. I look forward to your comments.
Head over. So I thought for a second Roger Pilon was going to have a heart attack because he doesn't often hear from the Heritage stage. I completely agree with Roger Pilon. So you're welcome, Roger. So that was great, John. I'm curious about something. So you've written about this before and talking about the Constitution, as being what was necessary. I mean, it was brilliant in all sorts of ways, but being what was necessary given that we were a country that was a few states, very much in danger. You had southern states with an agrarian background, mercantile background in the north, and it was a way of kind of compromising everybody in a way so that they could trust each other, and that trust was blown asunder after the Dred Scott opinion. We had a civil war, and then there was a recalibration with the Reconstruction Amendments. So we've had similar sort of constitutional revolutions since then. You mentioned the Warren Court. Certainly, there's been degradation of federalism. We now have an all-powerful Congress and all-powerful executive branches in some senses. So civil liberties have been expanded beyond anything that was in the Constitution. In other senses, civil liberties that are mentioned in the Constitution have been contracted. Why aren't we having a similar kind of ferment? Is it that people don't know, don't care, we're just too diffuse? Why have these issues not come up again?
I think, in part, the Civil War was the worst, right? So these other examples you mentioned, we've had winners and losers on happiness or happiness with different outcomes. But to me, they don't rise to the level of the Civil War.
That's true.
But why don't we have... I mean, you wouldn't be in business as a Civil War reenactor if the Civil War weren't the worst thing that ever happened to our country. I think part of it is people, and I think this is also, when I was preparing for this lecture, I went back and read General Mises' speeches on originalism, and he has this famous Tulane Law Review article. But before that, he gave several speeches. And if you want to talk about a period when you would have thought the Supreme Court can't be trusted, that we have deviated from originalism, it was much worse then than it is now, right? 1984 and 1985, think about what it was like then. William Brennan was writing a lot of majority opinions still in the early 80s.
Right.
So I think, General Mies spoke to the American Bar Association and he spoke at law schools to try to call the country back to a jurisprudence of original understanding. I think a lot of people still think that it's possible to reform, to recall us back to the original understanding through the Supreme Court, but through the bar, through places like the Heritage Foundation. I guess if, suppose if in 2020 Dobbs had come out the other way, despite all the arguments, despite all the appointments to the Supreme Court, then maybe you might think, yeah, things have gone so far, we have deviated so far from the original understanding, and there's no chance to bring things back, that then people might say, oh, the deal has been broken between the sides. Or I should have said, it's not just a deal between the North and the South after the Civil War, it's a deal between the government and the people as well. But I think we're, you know, the fact that we're here now talking about this shows that reform was possible. It was sparked actually by General Meeson, by the Heritage Foundation, ultimately, and the Federal Society. A lot of the students here who are in the clerkship. Oh, piece of advice for the students in the Clerkship Academy.
Please, they're hungry.
Don't screw this up.
So
I always wonder, in a liberal Clerkship Academy, do they say, use the judge for your own agendas? But so don't tell anyone.
You know, you're of course correct that, that slavery was a moral outrage and that there was a fundamental different viewpoint about whether, you know, black people were actually humans and deserving of rights. And you were also talking about the lifeblood of the economies of large sectors of the country. But I still sort of wonder about the states, even post-Reconstruction amendments, giving up that much power and sort of going, oh well, that's the Supreme Court said, Commerce Clause means whatever it means, and we're okay with that. By the way, I just have to say, so I used to have a goatee, and John has called me a Civil War reenactor ever since then, even though I'm from New Jersey. And I have had people.
I could see why.
I had people come up to me and said, I'm a Civil War reenactor too. It's like, I'm not actually a Civil War reenactor.
Oh, you made my day. You have shown the great reach of the Heritage Foundation. People deep in the backwoods who reenact Robert E. Lee feel that they have something in common with you.
There we go. So I want to follow up with you a little bit more about common good constitutionalism. So Adrian Vermeule, you know, we hit a vein. You wrote this right after Bostock, and there was a great deal of upset, and you know, it was in a Casey world, not a Dobbs world. But now we have had Bruin and a lot of, you know, opinions giving more robust protection to religious liberty, and we do have the Dobbs opinion. What do you see as the continuing allure of common good constitutionalism? Where do you think that's going? And how would, even if you were in favor of it, like, who's going to determine what is the common good and what role the judge plays in determining that and enforcing that?
So let me say, I have a lot of sympathy for Professor Vermeule's critique of originalism. We should take it as a challenge to all of us to provide a positive justification for originalism. I'm not saying that when General Meese gave his speech, it was easier to defend originalism. It was a different time when Justice Scalia, for example, he defended originalism by just saying it's the least worst theory.
Right.
He just said, this is the theory that narrows judicial discretion.
I don't have to prove it's perfect, just better than every other
opponent. Just narrows discretion the most for judges, right? But that's not a positive defense of originalism. That is, right, we know what the courts have been doing has been wrong in the Warren Court Revolution. We can replace that or constrain it. But I think Adrian's thrown down the gauntlet and said, I want you to provide an affirmative justification for originalism. It's an important challenge. I'm glad that it's there. We should not be complacent and think just originalism is just something that we all accept without thinking about periodically. So I think that's the task before originalists now, is to defend originalism. And his challenge is, and I think he's right about this, originalism itself is not moral or immoral without reference to some external value system. And I think his second point, which I think is also correct, is originalism as a theory of interpretation is really good or bad because the document, the legal document you're interpreting is good or bad. He doesn't say it this way. I would say it this way, though, is, you know, nascitur ab socius, or whatever canon of construction you want to use. You can use that with your parents, you guys, to impress them, because it's in Latin. Sidera absocius has no moral content one way or the other, right? What has moral content is the law that you're applying it to. And that's his. I think that's his main point with originalism. I think that's got to be correct. So originalism, right, advances moral values of one kind or another based on whether the underlying constitution, as originally understood, advances those moral values. Now, one argument you made is a criticism that's commonly made, I think, of Professor Vermeule's argument, which is, okay, you've said we have to interpret the constitution in line with the common good. Who gets to decide the common good? Are we going to be ruled by philosopher kings?
A lot of that he puts in the administrative state, saying, you know, they got some bright people there. Maybe they'll be the philosopher kings. Yeah.
So as I understand his argument, I think it's a subtle argument because it's not obvious that the administrative state should be the deciders of the common good. I think he believes that the administrative state is more rational than the other branches. And as the more rational decider of moral questions that are indeterminate, judges should defer to that somewhat before they choose to say, oh, I know what the common good is. In this respect, I think he's been very much affected by Justice Scalia, even though he would never admit it.
A clerk for him. I guess I would have said that essentially at the time the Constitution was ratified, you know, with some glaring examples, including the existence of slavery, we were a moral people, and as moral values have changed over time, there is a mechanism for amending the Constitution. You decide women should have the vote, you pass that, you decide direct representation of senators, you decide that there is a mechanism for updating the Constitution to take in line.
I agree. I think that's part of why I think I can say, you know, the United States is an exceptional nation, is a force for good. And so then the document that creates that nation state is good, is because of the fact we have a constitution and a nation that could improve itself, that could eliminate slavery, that could expand rights for women. We've had an enormous expansion of rights in the last, you know, since the Civil War. And so the union is what makes that possible. That's why I think Webster is right, the two are intertwined. If the Civil War had gone the other way, then maybe you could say we shouldn't think the Constitution is good. It did not produce a great nation.
Right.
It produced two separate nations that have a war with each other. You could be right about that. But I think the Constitution did create a union that could overcome a civil war and slavery. That's why it's a great nation, and that's why the Constitution is morally good too.
Well, but then why originalism as opposed to, you know, five justices on the Supreme Court saying, well, the moral winds have changed, so let's expand these vague terms and become a living constitutionalist. Why wouldn't that get us to common good constitutionalism?
Does anybody want to get in line to answer? Because I think there are not a lot of people going to agree with you. You're just baiting me.
I'm curious to hear your answer.
So part of my argument, at least, is that we have to, it's like a contract. You have to honor the original understanding of the contract, because the contract is what brought originally the North and South together to build the nation and to overcome the inherent distrust you would have between the two regions, despite all the potential benefits of the country. Right? The forces of distrust are so great that there is a civil war by 1860. So I think that's part of it. So I'm not arguing, for example, that although some people do argue this, I'm not arguing that we have to enforce the original understanding because the founders were better than us or more wise than us. Although I do think Alexander Hamilton sitting by himself could outdo all of us.
Right.
There's a great line John F. Kennedy had where he was saying he had all the Nobel Prize winners in the White House for a reception, and he said, this is the greatest intellectual gathering in the White House since Thomas Jefferson ate dinner by himself here.
Right, dined alone.
And sometimes when I write in the law, I figure like that's the way I feel about Alexander Hamilton, because I'm working on a book about Alexander Hamilton's constitutional thought, and you know he really covered so many areas with such insight. Anyway, I forgot your question.
That's okay. I'm not sure I see a book being turned into a musical, but you never know.
Jim Swanson's books, they've been made into TV shows. They give us all hope.
Hope is eternal. So I want to open this up now for questions. We have microphones in the room, so I want people to be able to call. Let's go over here.
Thank you, Professor Yu, for coming out. Question, if
it's always a pleasure to escape the People's Republic of Berkeley.
I noticed you had the sniffles. I don't know if you recall the DC pollen, but you're welcome.
I thought that was just the various drugs they had out on the West Coast.
It's John and the drink he gave you. If you were to look at the spectrum of Western democracies, and you mentioned how many Western nations view their more modern constitutions and instrumentalities. Let's put Israel at one end of that, and the United States perhaps at another. How do you think other Western nations would analyze your view of the Constitution? And I think Israel is probably the most fraught example, and we've seen it recently, notwithstanding what's happened.
That's a great question. One thing I want to emphasize is I'm not saying that my argument means particular provisions of the Constitution are moral in the sense, like, I don't think having a president versus a parliamentary system is inherently moral or immoral, or one's more moral, or one's less. To me, it's the fact of a constitution that we have that is the most important moral point because it created the nation. But you could have variations in the different provisions. So parliamentary system, federalism, they could be different, even within our system. When it comes to the spread across Western democracies, I'm willing to be corrected by others, but when I've talked to scholars in other countries and judges in other countries, they can't believe we do originalism. They think that's like, how could you do that? Why wouldn't you just interpret the Constitution's vague terms in light of your current moral understandings of the words? And why can't judges do that just as well as anybody else? So your point, Israel is just the farthest example of that because they don't even have a written constitution, and the Supreme Court says it can strike down anything that's unreasonable in its view. And it's like a sort of roving.
They just overturned a law that would have constrained
them. Yeah, it's their own power, right. Yeah, for being unreasonable. So yeah, that's the issue. But European judges and courts, for example, don't feel that they're bound by the original understanding of the people who wrote their constitutions. But to me, that's because they think of their constitutions as these sort of passing ships. They're just happy to use them, and then they're happy to toss them aside and replace them when they don't feel they work in any particular. But they don't view their constitutions as part of the meaning of their nation, it seems to me. So they would not have any attachment to the original understanding of their constitutional writing experiences.
How does that affect people's views of their own civil liberties and their ability to assert their civil liberties? Does it have an effect on that?
I mean, other people may have other experiences. My, it's a very, it's a gross generalization, but my sense is in other countries, they also think this natural rights idea you have is so charmingly quaint, but rights are just a thing you balance against the needs of society. It's not, and there's no absolute right. They think of it just one interest that you balance against other interests. They don't see it as a sort of trump card that it plays in our law. I think also in part because after Reconstruction, one thing I should say is the Bill of Rights are an important part of the story of the two sides committing to something, because the Bill of Rights are necessary to get the ratification of the Constitution in the very last states in Virginia and New York. So without that commitment to individual liberties by the government, you also have a failure of the two regions to come together. So individual rights in our experience are far more important than it is in Europe or Asia.
So I was listening to the arguments the other day on that, the Loper Bright case and the Relentless case, and some of the justices were questioning. I guess it was Justice Jackson was saying, "Well, my gosh, if we don't defer to agencies, aren't we going to end up getting like a lot more lawsuits where people are going to say the agency is screwing them in some way and limiting them?" It's like yes, and why exactly? I was thinking, oh, yes, and why exactly is that a bad thing? Why should the litigant that goes in that's taking away somebody's rights or impinging upon them in some way and say, you know, wink and nod, I win because I'm the agency?
I mean, here's an argument you don't actually hear made very often, I think, is what you hear critics of Chevron saying, or you didn't mention, so Loper Bright is about overruling yeah. Chevron, which is a judicial deference to agencies and their interpretation of the law. You hear in the discourse of people who are critics of that, that this is fundamentally anti-democratic in some way, although it does put more power in the hands of judges, but you don't hear arguments about morality, right? But why not? You know, why, if the administrative state is such an aberration, right, a distortion of our basic constitution, perhaps it is immoral to give the administrative state that much power in our system.
Right.
Whereas in Europe, which sees rights as this balance, the thing you balance, maybe it's not a problem. The other thing about the American Constitution and its commitment is this: we have a very decentralized government and a very under-resourced government compared to Europe. And I think that's also part of the original power-sharing deal between the North and the South. It's readjusted after the Civil War, but not fundamentally changed.
Yeah, in Europe too, you also have more diffuse powers in that you have the courts of a particular country. You can always appeal to some body in Brussels and mm-hmm. will oversee things. It's hard to figure out where your rights, the scope of rights that you actually have. Other hands? Yeah, let's come down here. Roger, come on down. Keep it short, Roger.
Roger, take all the time
you want. John, I don't understand your argument. You start out...
And that's after he agreed with you.
You start out with the question, is originalism moral? And then you answer that correctly by saying that it depends on what the law is. That's an independent criterion. But then you never really developed that. Toward the end of your argument, you went toward this agreement in the form of a constitution weighing in on that. Well, that original agreement sanctioned slavery without using the word. And so we have to conclude that the original constitution, that originalism under the original constitution was not immoral because it enforced immoral law. Is that the gist of your argument?
No, I mean, that I think is the argument of the 1619 Project, for example.
Oh, would, I see.
No, no, would it not be that, because they say, right, the Constitution sanctions the existence of slavery. Slavery is immoral. Therefore, the Constitution is immoral. Therefore, seeking the original understanding of the Constitution is immoral. But I think that, so my effort to address that is to say what determines the morality of the Constitution is not every single provision in the Constitution itself. Some might be moral, some might have no moral content at all, like whether to have a presidency versus a parliamentary system. To me, the morality is given to it by the existence of the nation of the United States in particular. I'm an American exceptionalist. So I find a lot of these criticisms of originalism come from a point of view that doesn't think the United States is anything special. Right? That's just like this question we had over here. It's just a spectrum, you know, it might just be one of a spectrum of possible outcomes. So my answer on the morality is that the United States itself as a unique nation has been such a force for good in the world that the document that created it is itself good. Even if there are various provisions in it that I agree with you are utterly immoral, like the allowance of slavery. But the Union also creates the possibility for the elimination of slavery, too. And that was Lincoln's insight. You know, Lincoln, and there were some radical Republicans, as you know, who thought ill of the Constitution. Right? It's a bargain with evil.
Right.
There were radical Republicans who wanted to suspend the Constitution during the pendency of the Civil War. I feel like the argument I'm making is very along the same lines as Lincoln, in that he thought the Union itself was important, had to be preserved. The Constitution is part of that preservation of the Union, what we would call the nation state today. And that is what allows for the elimination over time of deeply, immoral conduct and systems. Another question over here. Come.
Thank you, Professor Yu. What do you started with the Constitution, and you said a little bit about natural rights. What do you think of the period from 1776 and the Declaration to the Constitution? Are we a nation, and does it reflect anything about the Constitution?
That's a great question. And you know, the Supreme Court has fluctuated on this issue. Yes, so there's a case called, in fact, it's very much a part of the immigration debate we're having that people may not realize, because there's a famous decision, Curtis Wright, which claims that there is a nation state there before the Constitution, almost like independent of the Constitution. The reason the immigration comes up is because, as we know, the Constitution does not actually discuss borders, border control, or immigration, right? It talks about naturalization, and the Supreme Court in the Chinese Exclusion Act cases blessed this idea that there are certain aspects of sovereignty of the United States that have to pre-exist or exist whether the Constitution addresses them or not, and they have to be at the federal level, right? Which is why Arizona versus United States can come out the way it does, and that, gosh, I never thought before that I actually was on the other side of Arizona now because of this. But, and that, right, therefore, my argument would be wrong in that world, right? This is Justice Sutherland's theory in Curtis Wright. So I think my argument, therefore, has got to be that the nation doesn't exist between 1776 and 1789 in this kind of independent way, exercising sovereign powers, even though there's no real governing document. I think the Constitution is what allows the creation of the United States. I don't think the Articles of Confederation create a nation or even recognize a nation. They, if you read the articles, it talks about the nation really as being a league of states, you know, something like the NATO or the United Nations. So I guess I have to answer your question. So that doesn't mean natural rights don't exist in that time period. That part I agree with. I think natural rights, of course, exist, but the nation that can give them effect doesn't come into existence until there's a constitution.
Yeah, certainly we were doomed if the Articles of Confederation had continued. Ken?
Oh, can I say one more thing before Ken? So I think this is really interesting how it comes out in the immigration context, because actually if my theory of approach to the Constitution is correct, then states should have a much broader role in immigration, because this idea that the federal government just field preempts all immigration comes from this theory of the sovereignty of the nation being extra constitutional. Whereas I guess my approach would be, if the Constitution is this commitment between North and South, they create certain powers, but the general pattern is that states have reserved powers to regulate everything in the absence of a specific federal command in Article 1, Section 8, then I think Arizona was wrong, and that maybe Texas can do what it's doing on the border, although we have to wait to see if the Supreme Court overrules Arizona.
What's old is new again, right? Ken?
Yeah, I was going to ask a version of Roger's question, but I think I'll start it out in this way. Lincoln ends his Cooper Institute speech with the expression, "Right makes might," which sounds crazy. I mean, but it makes a lot of sense if you think of right as natural right and equality, and that is government by consent. That is that principle of justice, government by consent, creates a strong government that doesn't overrun its boundaries, that's a legitimate government. And I think when the problem is we think about slavery as a racial issue and not one of governing by consent. We don't politicize the relationship between master and slave. And so we don't recognize, say, slavery as the evil of the administrative state. And so Vermeul, I think, gets all of that wrong. So I like the conclusion of your talk very much, where you finally bring in the Declaration. But I'm sure I've missed some things that you're going to try to spin out and to put more
That's a very important point, Ken. One thing I think to understand I don't think I'm casting aspersions or anything. I think the common good constitutionalism challenge is based on a rejection of the social, you know, the social contract theory and the idea of leaving the state of nature and government based on consent. Right? I think rather to them the legitimacy is not give of the government is not based on consent. It's based on thousands-year-old tradition, in which, you know, democracy is just a blip as a governing structure compared to, right, all the thousands of years of the, right, the Roman Empire and then the kingdoms that followed after. I think common good constitutionalism looks at the just the rational law that has existed and developed over that entire time as actually the legitimacy, not consent. So I think you're right. There's a big difference between sort of the standard way of looking at America and rights and this new challenge to originalism. In terms of the Cooper Union, I don't disagree with you in the sense that naturally, Lincoln, I heard you and Roger and the Claremont friends, I hope, friends, that right, that the purpose that Lincoln saw and that others said was is that natural rights, their protection, is the purpose of government. And that's why we create a government. I wanted to see if I could come out even before then and say those natural rights are protected by a nation, the United States in particular. Not all nations, but the United States. And that's not possible without a constitution. And so that's my addition or parallel argument, is that that's why the constitution is legitimate and moral, not just because of the particular natural rights, but the fact that you create a government that can protect those natural rights.
Do you see common good constitutionalism as having a future? Where does it go?
I think if originalism can't answer common good constitutionalism, then we have problems, because I think it is a serious intellectual challenge, and you can't just ignore it. I mean, we should be honest about why we do what we do, especially when there's a majority of the Supreme Court who thinks they are originalists. And so, yeah, I said, who think they are originalists? I'm not sure if they actually are all originalists, but they say they are originalists. So I think it's a very important challenge, and it's one that, you know, has thousands of years of history. This was the dominant way of looking at laws and constitutions before the United States showed up.
I'm not quite sure how you'd implement it, though.
Well, they would say they've been implementing it for thousands of years all throughout Europe, which is maybe a good reason not to follow it, because everybody's here because we didn't like Europe or Asia as a place to live.
Over here.
Hey, Professor Yu, I'm a big fan. I listen to your podcast every month it comes out, so very happy to be here.
We have never met before, by the way. There's been no exchange of financial consideration.
Well, I do want my book signed afterwards, so.
Awesome.
Oh, my.
So when I take a step back and think about the originalist enterprise, I always get stuck on the idea that originalism was born in response to the excess, the war in court. And so that always leads me to wonder whether the founders would have been originalists themselves. So my question for you is, do you think that the founders themselves would have factored morality more into their way of interpreting the law more than modern day originalists?
That's a great question. And in fact, that was one of the early responses to General Mises' speech, were arguments by very prominent constitutional law scholars saying that the founders were not originalists. So if they're not originalists, why should we be originalists? And it's true, if you look at early major Supreme Court decisions, they don't, you know, look at the Federalist Papers, although I think part of my book argues that actually if you read Marbury and McCullough and all these, you know, Chief Justice Marshall is just plagiarizing Alexander Hamilton, I mean, ridiculously so. I mean, he should be paying royalties to the Hamilton family to this day. But they make no explicit references or citations to state ratification debates, although they do, you know, like Marbury does talk about how the ratification process itself was so much harder than passing legislation. But I think that was an important criticism, although I don't think it really answers the question, is which is, you know, whether we today choose a theory of interpretation shouldn't be dictated by what they did. I mean, that's, we would not follow all kinds of legal practices they did, I think. So I think it's, we have to justify it now under, you know, our current theories of constitutionalism, not whatever theirs were then. So my argument about, for example, the Constitution being this power-sharing agreement that allows the nation to form, I think that's what we have to do today to make sure the original contract between the two, and between the government and the people, are obeyed now. Because if we don't trust each other, regions don't trust each other, if the government and the people don't trust each other, then I don't think the nation survive, the union, as Lincoln would have called it, doesn't long survive, and then it can't do this job of protecting, you know, natural rights. What was your second question? Did you have a second question? Oh, yes. So this is actually an interesting area of scholarship. There's been a lot of debate about this. There are certainly decisions where the Supreme Court seems to factor in morality. I would say, for example, the case where the Supreme Court says, you just can't take from A and give to B for no reason. You know, there has to be some public purpose to it. They don't, strangely, don't cite the takings clause, which is sort of obviously on point. But there, you know, there's certain, my Claremont friends will often point out, innocent before proven guilty is not actually written anywhere in the text of the Constitution, but we have read it in from the very beginning, right? Through, and we read it in through the due process clause, but it does seem to be an external value from outside the Constitution. And this is part of the common good constitutionalism critique, which I think is fair, is that there are a lot of things in our legal system which cannot be answered by the Constitution. There's some kind of background norms which just make the system function, right? And so we have to figure out where those come from. And so they would say we should look to this civil law tradition as the answer. I tend to think, you know, as an originalist, you would look more to the common law of the 18th century and the way those common law lawyers expected the whole system to work. And they actually, I think, provide a lot of the definitions for terms and so on that I think the common good constitutional people are quite fair in saying can't be provided by just looking at an original understanding of the text of the Constitution by itself.
How's your Hamilton book coming along?
Oh, Jesus. It has taken a lot of work. The guy realized, I said, he wrote way too much. but it's not just an originalist enterprise, but I think Hamilton is, I think, really appreciated because he was a military commander and a brilliant Treasury secretary. I tend to think he gets downplayed. I mean, he's such an attractive figure of action. I think he gets downplayed sometimes because of the importance of his thought, because of all the other things that are so interesting about him. So, still working away.
I'm looking forward to it. Please join me in thanking John Yoo. Okay, fine.